Hello there, and welcome back, or welcome for the first time, to the Paradox Podcast. Today's teaching focuses on Numbers chapter 5 and is entitled Misogyny. Let's dive right into Numbers 5, verses 11 to 31, shall we? We read, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the Israelites and say to them, If any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, if a man has had intercourse with her but is hidden from her husband, so that she is undetected though she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her since she was not caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes on him, and if he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes on him and he is jealous of his wife, though she has not defiled herself, then." And it's here at verse 15 that we realize that these are instructions for what Israelite men are supposed to do if they think their wife has cheated on them and they have no proof. Now, as you read on through this passage of Scripture, it will become apparent that the woman is pregnant. And so a much more accurate description of what happens in Numbers chapter 5 is what men should do if they think their pregnant wife's baby is not theirs. Now, this shows how long ago the Bible was written, because we know what to do in 2019 if men suspect that their pregnant wife's baby is not theirs. The answer, of course, is to go on the Maury Povich show. Can I get a hallelujah? Yeah, the Maury Povich show is all about whether or not the pregnant wife's baby or the pregnant girlfriend's baby is the man she is dating or married to. But as hard as it might be to imagine, Numbers 5 takes place before the Maury Povich show. So men had no idea what to do when they suspected that their wife might be cheating on them and that she was now pregnant, and they wanted to have some sort of system or test to prove that the baby was in fact theirs or not theirs. So what we get in Numbers 5 for the rest of this passage is a 9-step process that God outlines to Moses for what men should do if they think their pregnant wife's baby is not theirs. We start with step 1, which is found in verse 15. "Then the man shall bring his wife to the priest." Now, this may sound like a big deal to you, or it may not, but you have to understand the layout of the Israelite camp in which this text is written. The Israelite camp was laid out like a plus or an addition sign. And on each of the wings or each of the stems, there were 3 different tribes. And in the very middle or the intersection of the addition sign was where the priests lived. So you can imagine, a husband starts to get suspicious of his pregnant wife, and he begins to take her all the way to the center of the camp. And you can imagine people seeing this husband taking his wife to the center of the camp, and all of a sudden we realize that this is a very public accusation the man is making of his wife. So that is step 1. The man brings his wife before the priest. We read step 2 in verse 15 as well. We read, "And he shall bring the offering required for her, 1/10 of an ephah," which is about a 2-liter bottle of soda. So 1/10 of an ephah of barley flour. That's the second step. "He shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance." We then read about step number 3. "Then the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. The priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water." So imagine the scene for a moment. At the center of the Israelite camp is the tabernacle, where the ancient Israelites believed the Spirit of God resided. In the outer court of the tabernacle, there is a basin that is filled with holy water. So the priest would hear this accusation that this man would bring, that his wife is possibly sleeping with someone else. The priest would say, "Do you have any proof?" And he would say, "No, I don't. I just have this suspicion." And the priest would then go into the outer court of the tabernacle, get some water from this basin, and then go into the tabernacle, grab some dirt from the floor of the tabernacle, and put it in the same cup. So now the priest is holding a cup filled with dirty water. We then read in verse 18, step number 4. The priest shall set the woman before the Lord, dishevel the woman's hair, and place in her hands the grain offering of remembrance. Now, this was a big deal because back in ancient Israelite culture, women wore their hair up unless they were in a private moment with their husbands. So for a priest to dishevel or loosen a woman's hair in this culture was the same as a priest exposing a woman physically before himself. The last part of verse 18 reads this, "In the priest's hand, the priest shall have the water of bitterness that brings the curse." Step number 5 then is found in verse 19. When the priest makes the woman take an oath and then lays out the terms of that oath. We read in verse 19, "Then the priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man has lain with you, if you have not turned aside to uncleanness while under your husband's authority, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings the curse." So what the priest is saying here is the priest is basically holding up this woman and asking her to take an oath that she has in fact been faithful to her husband. And he says, before you take this oath, may I remind you that I'm going to make you drink this dirty water. And if you are innocent and you are telling the truth when you take this oath, then you will take this drink shortly after that and you will be immune to whatever curse resides in this dirty water. You will be able to give birth to a healthy baby and then continue to conceive in the future. Which raises the question, well, what happens if she isn't telling the truth? And we find those terms laid out in verses 20 to 22. The priest says, "But if you have gone astray while under your husband's authority, if you have defiled yourself with some other man than your husband and have had intercourse with him, let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse and say to the woman, the Lord make you an execration," which is a fancy way to say a laughing stock. "May the Lord make you an execration and an oath among your people. When the Lord makes your uterus drop, your womb discharge. Now may this water that brings the curse enter your bowels and make your woman discharge. Your uterus drop, and the woman shall say, amen, amen." So if the woman is guilty, then her uterus will drop, which is an Old Testament way of saying she will have a miscarriage. But it doesn't end there, because the water will bring about some terrible, bitter pain, and then society, her tribe, will look at her as an execration, a laughingstock, a woman to be made fun of shortly after she's had a miscarriage. From there we go to the sixth step, which is found in verse 23. "Then the priest shall put these curses in writing and wash them off into the water of bitterness." So this dirty water now has parchment and ink in it as well. We keep reading about the process in verse 24. "The priest shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse, and the water that brings the curse shall enter her and cause bitter pain. The priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand and shall elevate the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar." Step number 7. "And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial portion and turn it into smoke on the altar, and afterwards shall make the woman drink the cursed water." Step number 8. We'll then read to the end of the chapter, because verse 27 reads, "When he has made her drink the water, then, if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain, and her womb shall discharge, her uterus drop, and the woman shall become an execration among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be immune and be able to conceive children. This is the law in cases of jealousy, when a wife, while under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes on a man and he is jealous of his wife. Then he shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall apply this entire law to her. The man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity." So the eighth step is that the woman drinks the dirty, bitter, cursed water. And then the ninth step. Everyone waits to see what happens. If the woman gives birth to a healthy baby, then she is proclaimed innocent. But if the woman suffers a miscarriage, well, then she is to be made an example of. And according to her tribe, her culture, and her religion, she deserves every ounce of blame, scorn, humiliation, and pain that she is feeling. And that, my brothers and sisters, is Numbers chapter 5, verses 11 to 31. Last Sabbath at Paradox, I invited Hilary Suho to share how these words made her feel. And this is what she said at Paradox.
So when I first read this passage, I was absolutely horrified. I have spent my whole life studying the Bible, reading it, and I had a hard time coming to terms with this. How could this be in the same Bible that I know and love? And I so badly wanted to defend it. I wanted to defend it to the point that I read the first five chapters of the book of Numbers, which is incredibly boring. It is just as boring as Craig said it was. It is going through all these statistics and numbers, and at the end, I was left with nothing. I wanted it to make sense, and I wanted to rescue the text, but I couldn't. At the very most, really making it stretch, I thought, well, maybe this process is to be a safeguard for women. Maybe when you live in a world with violent, powerful men, maybe this is made okay. Maybe it's tolerable when the alternative is being dragged to the edge of camp to be beaten with sticks and rocks by your jealous husband. But at the same time, I have a hard time reading this and then looking to the New Testament. When I read Ephesians 5 and it says, "Women, submit to your husbands, and husbands, love your wives," I see love and equal submission that I don't see in this text. So what makes me the most uncomfortable when I read this text was that last verse that Craig read. "The man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity." I found this verse disturbing and chilling, and I have three problems with it. My first problem is that the man is cleared. No matter what happens, no matter if he's abusive, if he's wrong, if he has nothing to bring to say, hey, this is why I think you've cheated on me, he's still guilt-free. And instead, his guilt is physically lifted from him and placed onto the woman. It's this weird perpetuation of toxic masculinity that says you don't have to feel something and your wife can bear it for you. My second problem was how the woman's identity is treated throughout this process. The text actually reads she becomes a curse. And even if she's not guilty, she's been publicly shamed at this point by the man who's supposed to provide and protect her. And there's no immediate solution either. There's no voice that comes down from heaven saying, oh, she is guilt-free. She has been faithful to her husband. Instead, it's just this waiting process to see whether or not she bears a child. And she's left no justice for her husband's accusations. Instead, she's left helpless and hopeless. My third problem with this text is how it treats miscarriages. It is just so callous. I remember when I was younger, my aunt tried to have a child several times, and they would try and try, and finally there would be a glimmer of hope where she was pregnant, and multiple times that was followed by devastation when she lost a child. And no matter how many times she went through that process, it was never easier. She was inconsolable. And I just imagine my uncle being there with her saying, it's okay, we'll try again. And then I imagine how painful that would be if he wasn't supportive, if he instead was accusing her. And I have a hard time with that. I can't imagine that pain. And now for a religious institution to wish that pain on someone, to place that pain on someone, I just have a very hard time accepting that. So while I look at this text and I want so badly to defend it, I have several problems with it. The Bible I believe in, the Bible I know and have read and love, defends the weak and the marginalized, and that's not what happens here in this text. Instead, I see a practice condemning women with the emotions of their husbands, and I see a woman alone, shamed at the feet of two men who seem more like strangers rather than a spouse and a religious leader. And at the worst, I see a callous approach to the dealing with sensitive miscarriages. So while I want to see a text that is inspired by God's love, instead I see a text that's filled with misogyny.
Now, Hillary used a very specific word to bring that reaction to a close. Misogyny. If you look up misogyny in the dictionary, the definition is a dislike of, contempt for, or ingrained prejudice against women. And when you think about this process or this ritual of the cursed water, the whole thing is ingrained prejudice against women. After all, a woman cannot bring the same accusation against her husband. It is only for the husband to bring, and in particular, the husband can only bring it when he has no proof. And I'd like for you to think for a moment what you would do if you were in my shoes. Imagine that you are a pastor and a young couple comes to you for counseling. And when you sit down with the couple and you say, "So tell me what's going on," the husband looks at you and says, "You know, I'm suspicious that my wife is cheating on me." And in this scenario, he turns toward his wife and he says, "I know you're pregnant." And then he turns back to you as the pastor and says, "I'd like for you to enact the Numbers 5 ritual because it's in the Bible and I'm a good Bible-believing Christian." Now, what would you say in that scenario if someone asked you to oversee this process that is outlined in Numbers chapter 5? Well, I can tell you what I would say. I would say, "No, we're not doing that." And if the husband pressed me further and said, "Well, why not? Don't you believe in the Bible?" I would say, "Of course I believe in the Bible. But we're not doing that practice." Why? Because it's misogynistic. That practice in Numbers 5 has deeply ingrained prejudice against women. And misogyny is incredibly immoral. Which brings us to the first point we need to make about Numbers chapter 5. When it comes to the dirty water that women have to drink because men are suspicious of their fidelity, and when we think about doing this practice in today's era, it's important for us to acknowledge that just because a practice is viewed as moral in the Bible does not mean that that practice is actually moral. Yeah, I know, right? Just because a practice is viewed as moral in the Bible doesn't mean that practice is actually moral. And if you ask me how I know, I would point to Numbers 5 and say, "There is no way I would ever oversee this today." Now, it's here where the tension from Numbers 5 starts to wear on us. Because Numbers 5 is in the Bible. And there are a lot of people who believe that the Bible is a moral compass for humanity. So if you go through and start labeling some practices as moral and other practices immoral, well, people then begin to wonder what you're actually basing that morality on. And so the whole tension of this text comes from the fact that it's in the Bible. Imagine if this wasn't in the Bible and I just told you about this practice, about some ancient tribe that did this as a way to determine whether or not women were being faithful to their men. You would hear that and say to yourself, "Well, you know, that's a misogynistic practice. We don't need to revitalize that or bring that back." But the fact that it's in the Bible all of a sudden creates all of this tension for Christians everywhere, because this is a practice we know is immoral in a book that we hope and trust is in fact moral. So I guess the question is, what do we do when the Bible normalizes and celebrates and even sanctifies misogyny? Because when we read about those things today, there is an incredible amount of tension when we read the Bible. And what happens is we keep the Bible at an arm's length. We skip over Numbers chapter 5 because it causes too much tension within our spiritual lives and it raises too many different questions. How do we make peace with the Bible when there is blatant misogyny in some of its pages? Well, I have found that the best way to make peace with the misogyny in the Bible is to name it. To say that passage is sexist. To say that ritual has ingrained prejudice against women. To say that Numbers chapter 5 is a misogynistic passage. Now, if we have the courage to name the misogyny we find within the Bible, I have found that there are three very important implications on three very different levels. These implications can be found on a communal level, and then a relational level, and then a personal level. And I'm going to close this teaching by talking about what happens when we name the misogyny in the Bible on all three of those levels. So let's begin with the communal level. Here in Numbers chapter 5, we have this story about what men should do with their wives if they suspect their wives are cheating on them and they have no proof. This process is created sometime around 1500 BCE. About 1,350 years later, we arrive at the Hasmonean dynasty in the 2nd century BCE. Now, the Hasmonean dynasty was a golden era of Jewish history. It was here that they became an independent nation in between the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, and there is just a plethora of Jewish thought and art and literature that is incredibly valuable. It was sometime during this dynasty that a group of people got together and put together the very first Hebrew Bible as we know it today. Now, we know very little about this meeting about how the Bible came together, the Hebrew Bible came together, but you can imagine that there was probably a committee meeting, right? And this committee meeting, probably composed mostly of men, they got together and they said to themselves, you know, we need to have an official Hebrew Bible. What books or what writings should we include? Now, you can imagine that one man stood up and said, well, we must include the law of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, the most sacred writings in our history. And you can imagine everyone around that committee saying, yes, amen, that must be so. We must have the writings of Moses, including the book of Numbers. There is no surprise that the book of Numbers is part of the Hebrew Bible. But what is surprising is that somebody, probably at that same meeting, stood up and said, you know, this Bible should also include the Song of Solomon. Now, it's here that I imagine a lot of people hearing this and saying to themselves, Song of Solomon? The book all about sex? That is disgusting, filthy, erotic literature. What, do you think 50 Shades of Grey should be a book of the Bible as well? And it's here that this man probably said, no, look, the sexuality within Song of Solomon is a metaphor. The drive that these passionate lovers feel for one another is a metaphor for how Yahweh feels about his people. And remarkably, the people around him heard this and said, okay, let's put Song of Solomon in. Now, if you read Song of Solomon today, you will find that it's very much in touch with the feminine experience, I have been told. And that it talks about what it's like to be a woman, to be discriminated against, and what women hope to be the future to be. And it's very likely, and I would say that it is most likely, that a woman wrote this book of the Bible, and it was included with 38 other books, most likely written by men. Now, about 150 years after the Hasmonean dynasty, we then come across the most important event within Christian history, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the central tenet of all of Christian theology. So, of course, all four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, include the resurrection in their gospel accounts of the life of Jesus, because without the resurrection, Paul tells us that our faith is in vain. Now, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John cannot agree on the details of this resurrection. They all think that a different group of people were there, that they said different things, that they heard different things. But there is one thing that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all agree on. All four gospel writers testify that angels first told only women about the resurrection. So the entire Christian faith hinges on men's ability to listen to and then believe women. Without that ability, there is no resurrection. There are no witnesses. And what's fascinating about this is in this same book, the Bible, we have the book of Numbers, where God embarrasses women with the ritual in Numbers chapter 5. And in that same book, we have Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, where God significantly empowers women. And the gospel writers would say this is the same God as the God who is putting this ritual into act in Numbers 5, which raises the question, well, which one is it? Does God seek to embarrass women? Or does God seek to empower women? Well, if you listened to the podcast last week, we talked about this question and we said a much better question to ask is what changed? Most Christians here say that God changed. And there are one of two answers for why God changed. The first one is something like this. God was filled with anger at humanity's rebelling against God. And so God was filled with wrath, and God's wrath was finally satisfied when God's son, Jesus, was on a cross, and there was so much pain and torture and heartache that God's wrath was satisfied, and now God can be a God of love. Another reason I've heard for God changing was that God recognized that humanity was in its infancy in Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. And it's here that God realized that God needed to be very strict and harsh and a disciplinarian for all of God's people because they were very young. But as humanity matured, God began to change because God realized God could be more hands off. And so the testimony is that God changed. But that negates the sovereignty of God. The idea that God is omnipresent and that God is eternal and that God doesn't change, that God is the same yesterday as today as God will be tomorrow. I think a much better answer to the question, what changed, is humanity. When you think about Numbers, the radical progressive idea is that humanity began to wake up to this idea that God is one, that there is only one God. And while that idea might sound radical to us today, it was just explosively radical thousands of years ago. But what happened was humanity started to realize the implications of this, because if God is God of all, then God must love all, not just one tribe. And if God is God of all, after some time and some generations, then God must speak to not only men, but to women also. And when you look at the Bible from that perspective, we stop seeing the Bible as a perfect record without error and begin to recognize that the Bible is the story of expanding human consciousness. So human beings believed that God wanted to embarrass women back during the time of Numbers. And after generations and generations and generations, there is this sense that God doesn't seek to embarrass women, but instead maybe God seeks to empower women. Now, what's discouraging about this story is about 400 years later, Christianity is much bigger and much more organized. So organized, in fact, that there is a council held in Carthage in 397 CE. Which is in modern-day Tunisia. And it's here that a group of men get together and they put together the 27 books of the New Testament. So these 27 books are talked about and discussed, and they're voted in as our New Testament canon, and they're 27 books that we have today. There's just one problem. There's not one female author in that group. And that deserves a giant Jesus facepalm. Here we go from God telling only women about the resurrection, making it so that men have to listen and believe them in order for the Christian faith to begin. And then, you know, centuries later, men make the decision to exclude the feminine voice from the Bible. Which means that when we read the Bible, it's important for us to acknowledge that the Bible is almost entirely written by men. Now, If it sounds like I'm against the Council of Carthage, or I want to change the books that are in the Bible, or I've got a problem with the Hasmonean dynasty, I want you to know I'm not saying that. I just want us to admit and acknowledge and talk about the fact that the Bible is written almost entirely from the male point of view. Which, when we go back to Numbers chapter 5 and we read through this really strange ritual that is dripping with misogyny, it's important for us to understand that Numbers 5 is the result of when men refuse to give authority to or include feminine voices. The Numbers 5 just shows that this is what happens when you eliminate the female voice or female authority. It's important for us to include this because otherwise we end up with just horrific texts that ask us to do immoral things. Which brings us to the communal implication of Numbers 5. Numbers 5 teaches us that institutions, workplaces, and communities need the feminine voice in order to be healthy. This is why it is so important. It is essential that the Christian church ordains women across denominations. Now, I'm not picking on one denomination in particular. There are several denominations in America right now that are struggling with the question of whether or not we should ordain women. And a big reason why we have such a big question is the fact that we don't really study Numbers 5. We don't open ourselves and expose ourselves to just how misogynistic religion can be. And when religion stands up and says, you know, God primarily speaks through men and then secondarily speaks through women, that's why we only ordain men, what someone needs to do is call that out for what it is: misogyny, ingrained prejudice against women, and then point to Numbers 5 and say, see, this is what happens when we don't include the feminine voice. Just this past week, I got to go to one of the most amazing experiences I have ever enjoyed in the community of Redlands. The University of Redlands held Beyonce Mass, which is the brainchild of the Reverend Yvonne Norton. Now, Beyonce Mass is where they interwove Beyonce songs into the Eucharist celebration, as well as a celebration of the feminine spirit throughout Scripture. The story that Reverend Norton highlighted was the story of Hebrew midwives saving children from the tyrant that was the Pharaoh as he was trying to murder them. There was this one moment that was just, I mean, it's just so beautiful to me, where she had this choir sing Save the Hero, Beyonce song, and they sang the chorus in between readings of Exodus 1 and 2, and it was just, oh man, it was phenomenal. It was so phenomenal that it changed forever the way that I will read and perceive that text. And it all came about because one woman, Reverend Yvonne Norton, had the courage to believe that God speaks to her just as much as God speaks to men. We must remind ourselves that our institutions, our workplaces, and our communities need the feminine voice in order to be healthy. So that moves us from the communal to the relational. Now, when we talk about relational, I want to talk to you about two things that happen in the Bible that people often overlook or misunderstand. We first need to talk about the biblical definition of marriage. Now, if you listen to this podcast before, you've heard me reference this before, but it must be stated over and over again. Now, most Christians hear the biblical definition of marriage and they think to themselves, okay, that's where God said that marriage is between one man and one woman. Well, God never said that in the Bible. And when you look more closely at what the Bible's definition of marriage throughout the Old Testament is, it's much closer to this definition. Women are property to be owned. Marriage was a way for a man to own a woman, which is very different than how the state views marriage in America today. Not only that, but the biblical definition of adultery is very different than our modern society's definition of adultery. Our modern society defines adultery as any extramarital sexual activity. But that's not the same as what the Bible would call adultery. For women, adultery in the Bible was any time a woman engaged in any extramarital sexual activity. But for a man, a man could sleep with whoever he wanted to, unless, and this is when it became adultery, he slept with the wife of another man. Because after all, that woman was the property of someone else. So it's important that we understand the sexual ethic that is informing Numbers chapter 5. Back then, men owned women as property and slept with multiple partners. Now, I know a lot of men who believe that is pretty much the ultimate sexual fantasy. To be able to own a woman and sleep around whenever a man desires. But get this, men lived in that world, and yet they were somehow still overwhelmed with jealousy. The whole text in Numbers 5 begins by speaking to men and saying, when you have this suspicion, this feeling, when your jealousy is uncontainable, then let me tell you what to do. So here is where we have to understand what Numbers 5 is. Numbers 5 is the result of the disturbing tension when men despise that which they desire. When they hate women enough to own them and yet also desire them. Because no matter how much money or power a man has, he is unable to control how a woman feels about him. This is captured in the excellent song by Bonnie Raitt, I Can't Make You Love Me. In there, the lyrics she writes are, because I can't make you love me if you don't. I can't make your heart feel something it won't. Which brings us to the relational implication of Numbers 5. Numbers 5 teaches us that consent is the foundation of love. Men felt urgency to own women. And yet when they owned women, they found there was an emptiness in that relationship because the women did not want to be in it. When I think about the church has spent a lot of time telling people what sexual sin is or is not. But what I think this church should do going forward is the church should talk about consent, the value of consent and why it is important to have consent in relationships, because consent is the foundation of love. Which moves us from the relational to the personal. I'd like to bring us back to that last verse in Numbers chapter 5, when God says, "The man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity." Now, the definition of the word iniquity is immoral or grossly unfair behavior. And it's here that the system is revealed that the man feels bad, and this system will help this bad feeling transfer from the man onto the woman. And it's here that we must recognize that Numbers 5 is the result of men's temptation to blame women for their problems. Men have been tempted from the beginning of time to blame their problems on women, as evidenced by the story in Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God comes looking for them, and God asks where they are hiding. And Adam says, "We were hiding because we were afraid, because we were naked." And God said, "Who told you that you were naked?" And Adam refuses to answer the question. Instead, he just says, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit from the tree, and I ate." "Look, God, if you would have never given me this woman," he basically says, "then there wouldn't be any sin on me or in this world." Now, unfortunately, this idea does not die. It is championed several thousand years later in the New Testament book, 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy, we read that Paul is writing this letter. Now, before we attribute what we're about to read in 1 Timothy to Paul, I've got to tell you, there are several scholars who do not believe that Paul actually wrote 1 Timothy. And while I am not a scholar, I believe in their scholarship, and I too do not believe that Paul wrote 1 Timothy for reasons we'll get into when we study the book of 1 Timothy. So rather than calling the author Paul, we're going to instead call him Paul. So in 1 Timothy 2, Paul writes, "For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor." So it's here that Paul writes, Adam is not to blame for this. This is all Eve's fault. And Eve represents every woman on the planet, and women are to blame for every sin on earth. Why does this author write this? Because he falls to the temptation that men have faced to blame their problems on women. Now, we can find several examples throughout Scripture where men are blaming their problems on women. But I want to highlight one in particular. This story revolves around David, who many consider to be Israel's greatest king. And you can find this story in 2 Samuel 11 and 12. Now, we presume that the author of 2 Samuel is a man, and so the narrator in this story is, in fact, a male voice. To tell his story, he writes these words, "It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing." Then the narrator adds a bit of interesting information. He writes, "The woman was very beautiful." David then asks the people around him, "Who is that woman?" The people around him know who this woman is. They say, "That is Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, aka David, if you sleep with her, that's committing adultery because she belongs to someone else." David doesn't care because he's the king. He invites her to his inner chambers and they have sex. Now it's here that we need to stop, because what happens here is a form of sexual abuse. David pressures someone who is less powerful than him for sex. The term we use for this is sexual coercion. And when you think about this story from Bathsheba's perspective, she may be standing before the most powerful person in the country who is asking her for sex and thinking to herself, "If I don't cheat on my husband right now, I might die." As the story goes on, after they sleep together, she then goes back to her house, but she sends word to David that she is now pregnant. David is so enraged that he has her husband murdered. It's a terrible story, and it was one that shows the immorality and horrific nature of this brutal king. Now it's here, though, that I want to go back to that verse that we read in 2 Samuel 11:2. Where the narrator is talking about David seeing this woman bathing on another roof. And the narrator says to us, almost as an aside, "Well, the woman was very beautiful." Now, why would he write that? I get the sense that he's leaning over to me as another man and saying, like, "Look, Craig, you got to understand, David was helpless. Like, she was a knockout." How would this story change, though, if instead of writing "the woman was very beautiful," the author wrote "the woman was very ugly"? Well, at that point, what the narrator is saying, if the story plays out in the exact same way, is the narrator is telling us that David is just a malicious, terrible, evil man. But because the author is citing Bathsheba's beauty, he's saying, like, "Look, Craig, Bathsheba's beauty was partially to blame for this because it rendered David helpless." When I read this, I am filled with disgust, because this sexual coercion and later murder is not the fault of Bathsheba at all. It is 1,000% David's fault. It is his heart that has this malice, that desires to use his power to bend people to his will. And David and the narrator of 2 Samuel both blame Bathsheba's beauty when Bathsheba's beauty had nothing to do with the assault that David enacted. Men, we face a temptation that's as old as humanity itself to blame our bad behavior and our problems on women. Nowhere is this more apparent today in our modern society than in cases of sexual abuse. Our legal system is without question tilted and biased toward the male perspective in sexual assault cases. And so often what happens is when a woman raises an accusation of sexual assault in court, the defense team often asks the woman about her sexual history. Because if the woman is promiscuous, the defense is saying, then she was probably asking for this assault to occur to her. Well, a woman's sexual history has no reason to bring about abuse. Not only that, but when we hear about women being sexually assaulted at parties, we often ask questions like, well, what was she drinking? Was she doing drugs? What was she doing at that party in the first place? Which raises the question, why aren't we asking the same questions of the man and saying, well, maybe the man shouldn't have been at that party. And maybe the man shouldn't have been drinking or doing those drugs. The way our society handles sexual assault cases, everything that we're talking about here is essentially biased toward men and this sense that men can still blame women for their bad behavior. But a few thousand years ago, Jesus Christ picked up on this on his Sermon on the Mount. When he talked about the way that men and women behave toward one another, he looked toward the men on this sermon and he said, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now it's here that we expect Jesus to turn to the women and say, "So ladies, cover up, because you when you expose yourself, men have these wild thoughts." But Jesus is a feminist, and he keeps his eye on the men, and he says this to them instead. He says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell." And then he looks at men's hands and he says, "And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell." Jesus Christ, the Son of God, looks at us men and says, "Is your heart filled with lust when women dress a certain way? Well, it's your fault, man. It's not her fault. Don't blame her for your bad behavior." The personal implications of being able to recognize Numbers 5 as men falling to the temptation to blame women for their problems is twofold. So first, I'll say a few things to my brothers, and then I'll say a few things to my sisters. The first is to my brothers. Numbers 5 teaches us that we need to stop blaming women for our problems. When we act badly, we should own it and say, "We misbehaved. We're sorry. And it's not someone else's fault." We are tempted, and you can point to any part of world history and recognize this temptation. We are tempted to blame our problems on women, and we should not fall subject to those temptations. To my sisters, Numbers 5 teaches that you are not to be blamed for a man's bad behavior. And if a man has attacked you, or reached out for you, or done anything inappropriate to you, and you have somehow been blamed either by the church or society, or your parents, or your friends, or even yourself, then I'd like to say to you two things. One, I'm sorry. The church has often defended men at the expense of women. And even the Bible has defended men at the expense of women. And it's unfair, and it's cruel, and I'm sorry. Two, you are not to be blamed for a man's bad behavior. You are not at fault for whatever he did to you or around you or near you. And to my brothers and sisters, when we encounter misogyny in the Bible, may we have the courage to name it, to call it out for what it is, and then to learn from it. This will change the way that we interact with each other in community, in relationships, and within ourselves. And may we strive to see and embrace Jesus Christ in all.